Welcome to Friday, and welcome to KUOW's Week in Review, where we figure out what happened this week and what did it all mean. I'm Bill Radke. With me today, Sydney Brownstone, a writer for The Stranger. Hey, Sydney.
Hey, Bill.
Joni Balter, host of Civic Cocktail on Seattle Channel.
Well,
hi,
there.
Joni.
How you doing?
Hi, I'm well, thank you. A little, you know, a little croaky. And Eric Liu, former deputy assistant to President Clinton, founder of Citizen University, author of the book I'm holding, You're More Powerful Than You Think. Welcome.
Thank you. Sorry you're croaky.
Thank you. Good to see you all. We'll croak through it. No problem. This week, Mark Zuckerberg apologized for letting a company scrape the data of 50 million Facebook users.
So this was a major breach of trust, and I'm really sorry that this happened. You know, we have a basic responsibility to protect people's data, and if we can't do that, then we don't deserve to have the opportunity to serve people.
This company, Cambridge Analytica, partly used data that Facebook users provided. When you post and like and share and fill out a personality quiz, it helps companies size you up. Computer scientist Jennifer Golbeck builds artificial intelligence tools just using that theory.
We can find out pretty much everything. Demographics like race, religion, gender, sexual orientation, behavioral things like if you drink or smoke or use drugs, we can tell your intelligence, your personality traits, your political leanings. We can predict future things like if your relationship is going to last or if you're going to break up, your risk for developing certain diseases, whether you have conditions like depression, PTSD, if you're suicidal, or, for example, if you're pregnant, if you'll go on to develop postpartum depression. There's research that shows we can predict all of those things just by analyzing little traces left behind on your social media profile.
Now, if you find that creepy, and I think creepy might be the word of 2018, you could delete Facebook. But here is Sydney's colleague at The Stranger, Sean Nelson, telling me this week why that would be hard to do.
I guess it's a stretch to think of Facebook as a party because it's not the greatest party of all time. But it's like leaving the party before the party is over. And so there is some element of, well, what am I going to miss if I don't? You know, what if I never see any of or talk to any of these people ever again? I mean, I mentioned in my piece yesterday that, you know, is it so inconceivable to live without, to just not have Facebook and go back to the world where we have to go search out our own, you know, newspaper and magazine articles or, you know, promote our shows with flyers or whatever. And that is a voice that I hear in my head about it. Like, I remember those days. And though I wouldn't say I was, you know, ecstatic all the time then, it does seem like the things were a little better then. But I don't think you can go back. I think Facebook is in the fabric and almost an indispensable part of living in the world now. And that alone makes me hate it even more.
Yes. Anybody here relate to that?
Oh, I think he's just summing it up perfectly. I think it's love-hate completely. I'm more of a voyeur myself on Facebook, except for the time I had the Vince Lombardi trophy and maybe a few civic cocktails I've posted. That's a long story.
You had a few too many civic cocktails and you started posting?
Was the trophy on your head? No, what was happening with it?
No, I was interviewing somebody at the Seahawks and they were trotting the trophy around then and I was able to hold it. Yeah. But all of that said, you know, I find that the pull of it is in, you know, knowing what your sort of high school friends and a few likable relatives are up to. and then it's disgusting. I mean, these guys creepy is the right word. You know, Facebook was founded, it seemed like, for like dating and showing pictures of your dog and sharing photos. And all of a sudden we find out that it's been weaponized to destabilize our...
All of a sudden?
I was going to say...
Well,
I
not all of a sudden, but to destabilize our democracy, which doesn't need any help right now on that front,
yeah.
Right?
You know, the thing that Zuckerberg spoke about, and by the way, he didn't apologize. There was never the words, I'm sorry, in what he had to say.
Not in his first statement. He did say, I'm sorry, in his when he was interviewed by CNN or whoever.
Yeah, because he got the message that he should have said, I'm sorry. But,
right.
But I think it's actually interesting, too. You know, we're all acting as if we're shocked that Facebook can actually get this data about us and predict our behaviors. And really, I mean, there was a breach there of trust in that they let a private company, Cambridge Analytica, scrape this info and use it in ways that not only for profit, but as Joni says, to destabilize their democracy. But the underlying truth of Facebook, which is that we give them everything about us for free and they exploit that to sell us stuff, if you haven't known that or realize it about Facebook, then you're a little bit of an idiot, right?
Yeah, I completely agree with Eric. And I think that Zuckerberg's apology that, you know, he has this duty to protect people's data is so disingenuous, because his entire profit model is based on working with data brokers who actually sell Facebook information that doesn't come from Facebook, like our magazine subscriptions, our car habits, our purchasing habits, right? And then Facebook combines that with their data to come up with these proprietary algorithms that help companies sell us stuff. So even if you actually don't belong to Facebook, even if you said, you know what, I don't want to participate in this scam, I'm off, Facebook actually maintains shadow profiles of its users. So even if you don't have a Facebook profile, they can find out information about you based on people who know you and their habits.
Yes, and also all this righteous deleting doesn't necessarily help, because even though they say they delete it, apparently there are backup files that they maintain and can keep for a very, very long time. While we're piling on Mark Zuckerberg, I don't want to miss one here. This is word to PR at Facebook. He is not your best spokesman. I get it that he's the boss, but he's so bothered by having to do interviews. If you listen to the tone, I watched his CNN interview. He's so annoyed that he has to actually come forward and sort of apologize and then kind of apologize. I actually think he should put forward the COO, Sheryl Sandberg, because she does a better job. She sounds more like she means it. This company, I mean, they really could fall precipitously, more than their stock did from this. It's such a violation of the public trust that they have to really make dramatic changes. They need to be regulated. A lot of new things have to happen. We have to change the way we all use and offer of information. But while they're in this process, please, anybody but Mark Zuckerberg.
You know, the last thing that Joni just said, I really want to underscore, we could change how and whether we use it, right? I mean, I think Facebook is a signal example of a phenomenon which is amplified by the internet age, but has always been the case, which is that, you know, when you throw away your power, when you give away your power, don't expect it to be used in nice ways or in ways that are just totally aligned with your interests. When you give away, in the case of Facebook, your data, your information, your stories, your, you know, a sense of your narrative identity, it's completely naive to expect that, you know, you can now claim back your power. I think one of the things that we can do actually is not only, it's not even necessarily to delete Facebook, but to put it in proper perspective.
Nationalize it.
Well, you can nationalize it as a utility, right? That's one way to go.
What do you mean, but proper perspective? Because what I keep hearing is it doesn't matter what your perspective, I'm another one of these people who, people call me a ghost on Facebook. It just really doesn't interest me, but I still have it. And what we keep hearing is they link up. My friends are linked up, and companies sell them stuff. So what does my perspective matter?
Look, Facebook is super useful for promoting stuff. You know, promoting events, promoting the fact that we were going to be on Week in Review today.
Right.
I mean, it's helpful for things like that. But
did you do it?
I didn't do it on Facebook. Uh-huh. But here's the thing. You have to remember, if we're, you know, my focus is on civic life and democracy. If we're going to heal the body politic, it's not going to be by making Facebook a little bit better or a little bit fairer. It's going to be by actually remembering how to deal with each other face to face, right? Face to face trumps Facebook every day of the week. And I think one of the things.
But you can't publicize Week in Review face to face, or you're
right.
Banned.
I can publicize using Facebook, but then what I'm going to publicize is, let's meet up face-to-face on, let's meet up tomorrow, Cal Anderson Park, for, you know, to March for Our Lives. Let's do these things that, I don't care how many, you know, if 100,000 people or 10,000 people in Seattle liked March for Our Lives, that would not have the force as the 10,000 or however many are going to show up tomorrow on Capitol Hill.
Yeah, but it makes it so much easier for a group like that to be born,
right?
And to let people
know. So use it
know.
For what it's used.
But that
for
is
that.
How it's used. But in the course of that, we're revealing too much about ourselves, and they're being untrustworthy in return, actually. Remember at the beginning of this, when this first came up, I'm back to Zuckerberg, you know, he denied it. He said that, you know, Facebook had nothing to do with the 2016 election. It's been a slow ride to get this guy to understand, and you say he's knew it all along, but get him to admit how pernicious it has been for our democracy.
Yeah. Sydney, I want to hear from you too.
Yeah, I just think it's individual action is so limited in its capacity to make change at this point because we are already so entrenched in this data harvesting economy. Whether we like it or not, our information is constantly being scraped by a network of companies that exchange it on this market in really shadowy ways that aren't really regulated. The other thing is, I think this is interesting that we're kind of acting like this has happened suddenly, because Howard Dean was celebrated for pioneering, you know, Facebook as a way to reach out to voters.
President Obama.
Obama's campaign, right?
Yes, hugely used it.
Yeah.
I mean, every movement of the last few years, Black Lives Matter, you know, the Dreamers, Fight for 15, have used Facebook effectively. I'm not so that's why I say, you know, don't just, it's not an either or. It's not embrace it with all its flaws or just delete it. Recognize where it can be useful and where it's powerful in amplifying voice and allowing folks to network up. But I think, look, in media diet and social media diet, as in our actual diet, you are what you eat, right? And I think, you know, the thing about Facebook is if you use it to publicize stuff, but if you're not just, you know, if you can control what you eat, if you're not just clicking on things that are meant algorithmically to dial up your hormonal rage and to get you kind of fired up and righteous and angry in the way that that Russians, among others, were able to exploit, then that's what I mean by keeping it in perspective. It's a useful tool. It should not be the sum total of our public identities or civic life.
And it's not just Facebook. I mean, you have to think about every time you do a Google search. If you search for a hotel, it is then all over you on all your media. They know everything about you. Google, you know what I find especially creepy about Gmail is now when you write a note to somebody, they sort of read it, know what your answer should be, and offer you three choices at the bottom of the note. Like, hey, that's great. And it's like, I don't need Google to write my notes for me. And I find it absolutely appalling / creepy that they know what I should say next. Ooh.
Yeah, I mean, the other creepy thing is that Facebook has been conducting studies on its users this whole time to find out what makes them tick, right? So in addition to exercising our self-control and developing a media diet that actually searches for facts, I mean, Facebook has been toying with our emotions to see whether certain things make us happy, certain things make us sad. And this is really disturbing to me. For example, I do a lot of reporting on sexual assault. So I noticed one day on my Facebook feed, all the ads served to me were for online therapy programs or for rape whistles. And I was like, what does Facebook assume about me? And more importantly, how are they trading this information with that data harvesting economy? And how is that going to impact my health insurance? How is that going to impact my credit score? How is that going to impact my loans? We just can't see any of it. And I think this is why that entire economy needs to be regulated.
Let me say something about that for a moment, because Sydney, I think you probably know, it's not just your feeling. I asked this computer scientist in that interview this week about, yeah, so why wouldn't companies, a company who could potentially hire me, buy information about these wonderfully educated guesses you're making about whether I'm depressed or addicted or have a pre-existing condition, et cetera, et cetera. And she said, oh, I get those requests all the time. I say no. Well, great. Professor Jennifer Holbeck of University of Maryland says no. In other words, it's happening.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's, you know, I don't know how many of you have watched that show Black Mirror on Netflix, but it, you know, that dystopian kind of near future in which all this stuff is happening and embedded into our everyday lives is right around the corner. And I think Sydney's point is really important because it's not just Facebook. I mean, she's describing what we're talking about here is the fundamental model of online advertising.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so, you know, the need for regulation of that. And the need for regulation about the ways in which tech companies like Facebook and PS, in our own backyard, Amazon,
mm-hmm.
Are these titans and exercise powers that are, you know, monopoly powers over not just the commerce marketplace, but over our marketplace of attention. You know, these require actually some public policy remedies that I think the Facebook controversy is going to finally put a little bit more to the center of the radar screen.
Okay, let's talk more about those policies later. We got a whole week in review to review. So thank you for this, Eric Liu and Sydney Brownstone and Joni Balter. And we're going to talk about the many dramas in transit around here. That might sound boring, but it involves President Trump and streetcars that we do or do not desire and escalators that we should or should not walk on when they're motionless. It's fascinating. Stay tuned. On with the Week in Review, and we're live tweeting, of course, at KUOW, so come join us. This morning, President Trump signed Congress's new budget, which includes money for the Northgate Linwood Sound Transit light rail line. Trump had threatened to slash federal transit grants, but this morning he said he had no choice.
There are a lot of things that we shouldn't have had in this bill, but we were, in a sense, forced. If we want to build our military, we were forced to have. There are some things that we should have in the bill. But I say to Congress, I will never sign another bill like this again. I'm not going to do it again.
Eric Liu, you worked in the White House. Why should a taxpayer in Florida pay for the Northgate Linwood Sound Transit light rail line?
Why should a taxpayer in Washington State pay for hurricane relief in Florida? I mean, because we are part of a union, because the idea of paying taxes in the United States is not about a transaction of customer service, and I want to see my receipt. It's about trusting that our representatives in government have made some sane choices about national priorities, and we contribute to the common pot there.
But what would happen if every local municipality all around the country paid for their own completely local transit system?
Well,
what would be
places
the difference?
Like Seattle would be just fine, and then places, even a few miles away from Seattle would be sucking wind. Because if you head to this kind of, not every man for himself, but every town or township for itself, you quickly eliminate the possibility of actually, whether as a state or a country, achieving any greater good than what a small, hoarded group of people with wealth want to do.
So today Trump asked for a line item veto. Maybe he should have vetoed our local light rail line so that some other place in a poorer area could have their light rail line, because money's not infinite?
I think one of the things that you have to make a choice on when you're making a budget, whether you're in Congress designing it or whether you're the president choosing whether or not to sign it, is to not get at the level of line items, but to ask at the level of big priorities. You know, Trump said, he was forced to sign the spending bill because he wanted to, raise funding for the military. Here we are, it's 15, 16 years into a war without a seeming end, and in a country where our military budget's never been higher, and yet where none of us are being asked, except those who voluntarily serve in the military, none of us are being asked to do anything to actually contribute to the cost of fighting that war, right? If you're making a budget, let's ask questions about, hey, should we be winding down the wars? Should we be investing in what happens with veterans after they come to the war? Should we be doing other things to invest in our own people here, but not at the level of should this city or that city have mass transit? That's insane.
Okay, insane. Wow. Any more reaction on that?
Yeah, I mean, I just think funding transit should be a national priority. And I mean, every other country, well, not every other country, but most other countries in the world seem to assume it is. And the idea that it shouldn't be, I think, is really rooted in this Tea Party ideology that we saw crop up, I don't know, 10 years ago, where, you know, you started having these towns in like Florida rejecting federal grants because they thought it was part of a UN plot to take over the world. I just don't understand how you have a country without interstate highways and a railroad.
Well, interstate highways do serve the entire country.
Right, right. Well, Amtrak serves significant parts of the country, too. And light rail serves different communities that string together different counties. I absolutely think the federal government should be playing a role, because as we've seen, sometimes the state doesn't fully fund our transit priorities.
Right.
Well, fortunately for us, it's always opposites with whatever President Trump said. So he said he would never sign a deal like this. The good news is that means, of course, he'll sign a deal like this. You know, he's trying to say he doesn't approve of these sort of trinkets for Democratic cities. But he doesn't even mean that. And, you know, this whole bit of like, you know, each local should pay for itself, that comes up almost always in every legislature, where the sort of rural areas say, I don't want to pay for the stuff in the big cities. And if you look at the spending, education, transportation, the big cities are so exporting dollars to the other parts of their states.
Yes.
And it has to be that way. Of course it's that way, and we shouldn't complain about it. It's just the way it works.
Speaking of transit, Seattle's streetcars are in trouble with the mayor. Mayor Durkin has ordered an independent review of the downtown streetcar project after it came out the city transportation department may have seriously underplayed the cost of operating the streetcars. There are two streetcar lines now, one from South Lake Union to Westlake, another from Pioneer Square to Capitol Hill. Now the city's connecting them with a streetcar down First Avenue. It's all over budget, as usual, but does anyone think we're going to leave these two lines unconnected?
I sort of hope we kind of reevaluate and redecide, because it seems like these streetcars, I know there were votes in 2003, 9, 10, and all of that, but it seems like they sort of just came out of nowhere. And suddenly, you know, streetcars, we're going to clear a whole bunch of streets for them, and there's very few people on them. Hilarious that they don't even work in the area where they started, South Lake Union, for Paul Allen. That was the dream. You had to have streetcars, but now they don't even move. What did Danny West need to say? 15 clicks a minute or something like that.
Yeah.
But, you know. Yeah,
they work, but they're all sludged
hardly.
Up down there.
But they're
Seattle Times said that the streetcar carries in South Lake Union carries 20% fewer riders today than it did 6 years ago. I looked at the website of the city streetcar plan, and the website ridership data stops it in May 2017.
You know it does. You know it does. These are, look, white elephants that we can't give back. I interviewed the mayor on the first day, her first day in office back at the end of November. And I don't know why, but I just said, what's up with these streetcars? And she said, she went into this thing about part of a bigger transportation system. And so I looked at her and I said, so you don't ride them either? And she just cracked up laughing, because she doesn't ride them either. I don't think anyone here rides them either. And we should review it, because, you know, I think a 50% budget mistake is something that we wouldn't tolerate with a nuclear plant. Why should we
tolerate with a public library? I mean, I think
exactly. So why should we tolerate with this?
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I think, you know, Joni used a word a second ago that I want to highlight, which is redecide, right? I think, this is important, because the central question in all of civic power always is who decides, right? Whether the topic is immigration or regulating Facebook or streetcars, whatever. And so you have a situation now where more and more Seattleites are frustrated with the cost and the non-usefulness of this streetcar system. But I think most people are illiterate in their ability to answer the question, well, who decided this and who decides how we might change this, right? And so I think part of what we got to do here is look at, well, what is the pathway to decision? If this is a city council issue, which primarily it
was,
is, right?
Yeah.
Then who on the city council decides? And how can we, you know, who from the city council can be sitting here right now to say, yeah, we actually ought to change the way we do this, and maybe not extend and expand the streetcars, and you know. But I think that the
two unconnected streetcar lines.
But there's another disconnection, which is between general frustration and rage in the public, and an actual understanding of how to fix it, right? And I think part of our job, certainly those of us sitting around the table here right now, is literally to help fill in that gap. Well, talk to this member of this committee of the city council. And just because the mayor's ordered a review of the spending doesn't mean that the mayor's able to decide. She doesn't have a magic wand as the executive, right? And so we got to figure out how we want to move who on council through what channels to get this changed.
Or we could just directly petition SDOT to throw those streetcars into Elliott Bay or turn them into turn them into temporary housing. I mean,
who will defend the streetcar?
I'm just saying, they seem like they're built exclusively for tourists. And I was not here when the city council voted initially to develop the streetcar, but it seems as if the thinking was, oh, San Francisco has them and they're super cute. Tourists love them. Why can't Seattle do the same? Well, because Seattle's a different city. It rains all the time. We're not as, I don't know. It's very different. And I fully support redeciding.
Yay, redeciding.
Well, one thing I know I've heard said on behalf of streetcars is that it's this clear route. It's on maps and it's fixed, and everybody knows, oh, if I want to go to here, I could just get on this line and I'll get off.
And take four hours.
And that buses, and then it's difficult for people to know all the routes of all the different buses. That's what I'm
well, the other
I've
thing,
never ridden the streetcar.
The Danny Westley column that you referred to in the Seattle Times actually opens up the underlying issue here, which is cars, right? The reason why the streetcars in South Lake Union move it across is because they're stuck in car traffic. And and I think the thing that we've got to ask ourselves that he began asking that column is, should that be an area, South Lake Union, where you don't allow cars? Your streetcars will work awesome if you don't have automobile traffic, right? And which raises a larger question in Seattle. Should there be more areas where you are doubling down on transit of different kinds and restricting automobiles? And
But the streetcar is just along one fixed route, and so he would eliminate car traffic in this grid in between the main arterials, right? Denny and Fairview and Mercer. So it would be, and it's not like a big park. It's just it would be off.
You didn't want to kind of
a
be,
commons, for instance.
For example.
Commons. Oh heavens, let's not talk
so
about that.
So it's offices and restaurants with streets that people can cross willy-nilly and dodge bicycles?
You know, one of my kind of general slogans in life, which happens to apply literally in this case in Seattle, is whenever you're, you know, sitting in traffic, whether behind a streetcar or whatever, is to remember this. You're not stuck in traffic. You are traffic.
Uh-huh. Oh, I like that.
That's good.
I like that.
Oh, good one.
That is true of, you know, you're not stuck in a broken, dysfunctional city politics. You are that if you're not trying to change it one way or another. Right.
Right?
And
there's that activism coming through there. That's awesome. But think about this. So if you add 45,000 people to a neighborhood, what did you expect is one thought I had, because are they all supposed to kind of roller skate through? How does this work? So I'm willing to try Zona Pedonale in Italian. It's for pedestrians. It's a pedestrian zone or a
Sounds
a
fancy the way you say it.
It sounds better the other way. But or a traffic limited, which allows, like, I think food trucks and a few cars for, you know, specific cars with specific plates in. We can try that. I don't know if it works in this rainy town. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. It's certainly worth a try, because the whole idea, you know, look at what happened to Seattle. You can't get through that area anyway, even if you're not going there. You can't get, the east-west commute is totally hosed.
I mean, I think we already know that a car-centric society in Seattle doesn't work. So the question is, what do we do next, right? Like, we know that cars driving through Pike Place Market, it's a terrible idea. I don't know why there are any cars down there. I'm sorry, this is a major pet peeve that I have. I am so mad every time I visit Pike Place and there are cars on the street. What did you expect driving down there?
Yeah, exactly.
It's supposed to make you smile.
Well, but if you're a citizen and you're agreeing with us, and but you're wondering how what you can do, I mean, I think one place to point people is citizen organizations like Transportation Choices Coalition. Right? Mm-hmm. You have these organizations that are trying to organize people not only to come up with options B, C, and D, but to actually move them. And I think that's the, again, filling in that gap between road rage and rage about road rage on the one side, and actually making change happen.
And pressure the city council, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I would use the streetcar if it came along to it. But one car I do use is the little car that goes above the streets, which is the monorail when I'm down there. And the monorail would like to be more used than it is. And so Seattle Center.
You asked it recently?
Yes. I'm anthropomorphizing the monorail. It's
it does
lonely.
Speak. It does speak.
Yeah, it feels
Facebook
misunderstood.
Facebook can analyze
this
it.
This is a Pixar movie, I see it.
Yes. Monorail says, I've done everything you asked of me, which is very, very little. I go from one place to another and I turn around again. Reliably.
I'm bored as
What's
heck.
Wrong with me? Yeah, I'm bored.
It's bored.
Yes.
Sisyphean.
Come play. Please come play with me. The Seattle Monorail Service and the Seattle Center have released a survey wanting to know, well, what do you think about the monorail? How do you use it? How could it be better? That's a question we've been asking since 1962.
But the future of monorail in Seattle is really a larger and longer question. It relates to the need for rapid transit in the developing metropolitan world. Trunk lines to airports and suburban areas, for example. The World's Fair preview may answer some questions in the same way that early space flights did. From this, there could come a pattern of the future. But whether or not this is a milestone in transit history, the future will decide.
Thank you, King Five, for reminding us how we spoke in newsreels.
I love the way he said metropolitan.
Well, the future decided, didn't we?
Yeah, I guess. So could the monorail do anything to win more of your love?
I think the only way the monorail could win more of our love is twofold. One is, I guess, and I didn't know that they could be better integrated with Sound Transit. I didn't even know there was a connection there, but also maybe with Uber and Lyft.
How would they be integrated?
Well, some way that you know that you can sort of Uber, you can certainly Uber to the monorail, but could you get picked up easily in a spot? And I hate to open this can of worms. I hate myself.
Oh, wow.
Maybe extending it a little bit one way or a little bit the other, just so it could be
expand
more
expand the monorail,
oh,
says Joni Balter.
all over the city.
Self-hate. No, not all over the city. Just to make it slightly more usable, because we're now about to write off any traffic in South Lake Union, so we got to get from here to there a little bit, you know?
Right. Gondola.
I just have a hard time finding how to get on the monorail. Like, in Westlake, it's kind of hidden inside
a mall.
It is
hidden. Why is that?
Yeah,
it's not clear.
Yeah. So, I don't know. It just... This is also my problem with light rail at the airport and the UW. I mean, if you take light rail to the airport, you then walk, you know, several hundred meters to get to the your terminal, and then at the UW, it's just it doesn't seem super intuitive for pedestrian connections to the light rail.
Do you remember the original design for Sound Transit at the airport? It was going to stop 1 mile north of the airport,
right.
So that would have been even more ridiculous, right, than the distance that we're traveling.
Or as Sidney Brownstone says, several hundred meters. Where did you grow up that you think in meters?
I actually did spend part of my childhood in England.
Yeah, I'm picking up on that.
Whoops.
Okay.
Garage.
By the way, you know, we're on Twitter at KOW. I'd be happy to read a better defense of the streetcar than I was able to muster. If there's a streetcar lover, we're at KOW. Since you brought up the light rail station and University of Washington, did you hear what happened to our escalator-based transit this week? How could there possibly be a problem with escalators, asked comedian Mitch Hedberg a few years ago.
I like an escalator, man, because an escalator can never break. It can only become stairs.
I don't know where you're going.
There would never be an escalator temporarily out of order sign. Only an escalator temporarily stairs. Sorry for the convenience.
And yet, this week when the escalators got stuck at the Husky Stadium light rail station where there's no public staircase, the Sound Transit would not let people walk on those stairs. They made passengers stand in 40-minute lines until the escalator moved again. I found out in the Seattle Times that both the escalator industry and our state government say people should not walk on stuck escalators because the stairs at the top and bottom are smaller than the stairs in the middle, and that's a tripping hazard, although other states do let their transit riders brave that hazard and walk on stuck escalators.
This was an actual prissy fit. This is too prissy.
Prissy fit.
Prissy fit, because honestly, just like your comedians here, you can walk up and down escalator stairs. This happened to me 2 days ago at LA airport. Of course the escalator was out, and of course the passengers were undaunted and they were grabbing their very large suitcases and going up and down the broken escalator. I don't know why it's just like an overreaction to something.
I'm sure it's a liability fear.
I'm sure it's liability, but somebody should have realized if you're not putting in the stairs, yes, I know you have an elevator, but not everybody's going to leave that exact spot and go wherever the elevator is, how many meters away.
And cram into that elevator.
They're going to go charging up if it's possible. And this is ridiculous.
I use that light rail station all the time, and the escalators are very often stuck, and you just don't hear about it.
Did you go charging up? What did you do?
Of course,
I want to know.
You go up and down. Yeah. Everybody does. And the escalator, one of the escalators this week, it stopped at 1:30, and that wasn't reported until almost 4:30. And the CEO of Sound Transit, Peter Rogoff, reacted this way.
The inconvenience caused to our passengers departing UW station on Friday afternoon was unacceptable by any measure. Sound Transit is conducting an intensive review of Friday's circumstances while working with our contractors to tighten up our reporting and response regimes to ensure that episodes like Friday's are not repeated.
But you know why nobody reported it? Because no one cared.
That's what I was
Because they
say.
Were walking.
Well,
what
also
were they
because
doing?
They knew that the answer was going to be that very bureaucratic sounding sentence, right? I mean, what we're talking about here, the idea of, oh, the escalator's not working, I'll use it like stairs, is something called common sense,
yeah.
Right? And a lot of, whether it's a liability regime or just bureaucracy and the way things operate slowly through something like Sound Transit, you have this absence of common sense built in and this fear of somebody working the station today saying, oh, I don't have the authority to let people walk up the stairs. I'm going to pass this one up until it goes all the way up to the chain of command to the CEO of Sound Transit 5 hours later.
We need slower reporting, because if someone had reported it right away, then those 40-minute long lines would have happened for hours more than they did.
No, but this is a design thing. When they said, hey, this area is too narrow to put the stairs in, did someone say, when we have an escalator, we better talk to those guys over there with escalators. When it goes down, which it does in power outages, and just because it doesn't feel like working or it's broken or something, then that is the time to say, are there enough railings? Can we just let people go up like Bill Radke did?
You know, not to sound like the libertarian that I am not, but This is a pretty good both example and metaphor for citizens having to remember their own capacity just to fix stuff and do stuff and not wait for permission from government agencies.
If you're stuck on the escalator, you are the escalator.
Yeah. If you're stuck on an escalator, you've got bigger problems because you haven't been able to figure out a solution to being stuck on an escalator.
And I think it's a civic culture that's really lacking in Seattle. I just conducted my own exhaustive review of the problem while you were speaking, Eric, and the answer is we just use the escalator as stairs. But no, I find this more commonly just, you know, in riding the bus or riding light rail. You know, Seattleites don't really know how to do it yet. We're not used to being packed in public spaces with other people. I you know, every city seems to have its own definition of what private space is. And if people get crammed in a bus or a light rail car, they don't know how to, like, shift and move around and make room for other people. It's just kind of, you have to develop this peripheral awareness that's a little bit bigger than yourself on how to be a gracious citizen, and Seattleites could do some work on that.
I think they should have stormed the escalator. Those people held back.
Well, you know what? Somebody didn't trip because they stood in lines. You know, it's all fun until somebody trips because the stairs are skinny at the end and fat in the middle. So, but they're still going to talk about this. The Sound Transit is talking about this incident at their next meeting on April 5th, and you, citizen, can presumably be part of this meeting.
We're sending Eric.
Oh, by the way, we got some Twitter feedback on the Seattle streetcar. Maggie tweets at KUOW, first time tweeting. Wow. Thanks, Maggie. She has a Twitter account, and it's her first time tweeting because of this.
This sounds like a Russian bot to me.
I agree.
Maybe just first time to this program. But Maggie says, at KOW, first time tweeting, I love my streetcar from Pioneer Square to First Hill. Be discreet in your assessment. That's fair. I haven't ridden them, so I am being discreet. We just got another one on Twitter, which says, at KOW, I love the streetcar, aside from one particularly cantankerous driver. Oh, they're charming. The cantankerous drivers are charming. But that was me, not the tweeter. Sorry. Aside from one particularly cantankerous driver. But the problem with it is that it drives with the traffic and defeats the purpose. It needs a designated lane and or traffic officers manning the congested turning lanes, end quote.
So we need more space dedicated to them while they can't get through the traffic areas. Sounds good.
You could put it.
Well, yes, actually. If you did, then people would ride them. They would be full of people for whom this was the fastest and maybe even only path through that particular corridor.
It would be light rail.
I would love to know if Maggie likes it because she has it all to herself.
Yeah.
really, Maggie doesn't have to be anywhere on time.
Wow. Okay.
Sorry, Maggie. I'm sorry.
I apologize, Maggie.
Yeah, we love you.
As long as that's really your name.
Real Maggie, right?
Right.
It's the Russian bot army. I'm sorry.
Okay, let's talk about whether the idea of rent bidding, a platform that lets you bid on the apartment or the house you want, is that okay? We put a pause on it here in Seattle while we figure that out. That and more coming up in the Week in Review. The former deputy assistant to President Clinton is here, Eric Liu. The host of Civic Cocktail on Seattle Channel is here, Joni Balter. A writer for The Stranger, Sidney Brownstone, is here. Hi, Sidney.
Hey, Bill.
We're all reviewing the week, and this week, the city of Seattle put a one-year moratorium on rent bidding platforms. These are apps and websites that let landlords take competing bids for apartments and houses. At least two platforms have been operating in Seattle a little bit. The city resolution says by allowing landlords to easily take bids, the platforms can drive up the cost of housing. So our affordable housing plan involves making it harder for landlords and tenants to agree on a price. Is that about right?
Our affordable housing strategy should not put even more power into the hands of landlords to get potential renters into a war with one another in a real-time online bidding war. I mean,
it's just transparency, though. Like, you could underbid, you could send the landlord your documents because they make you give them their pay stubs and letters of recommendation.
Right, and I could write an angry letter to the editor on paper to KUOW, but if I tweet it right now, it has a different kind of force and it changes the dynamic of things. And so if you put this in an online instant way where you're seeing everybody bid things up,
psychological effect.
Psychologically, this plays to the benefit of only one party here, and that is the landlord, right?
Well, to finish my thought, though, you could, for example, bid less than your asking price because, and say, like, I've got all my documents ready. It's just whatever you're going to do, you can, whether the price goes up or down.
Today's Seattle market, though, you're not too often going to see a bidding war to the bottom among.
But that could these things change, right? So if Seattle's market were overvalued, Mayor Durkan is warning that's going to happen. Everyone's warning that's going to happen eventually. What goes up must come down. If the market is overvalued, the idea, I'm not defending, I haven't used these sites, but the idea, the theory is that whatever the market is, you'll know it faster because this is just a transparency site. And if we can't get the money we're asking for these sites, we'll know it. We're for these apartments.
The question shouldn't be this site or not. The operating question is, if you care about affordability of housing in the city, what gives renters more power?
Not that site.
Yeah, I mean, I think the idea is absolutely unethical. I think that housing is a human right, and the idea that, you know, this is completely determined by the private market, I think is already, we're already screwed.
Well, that's fair. So it's a kind of rent control. It's a way of...
The rent bidding is a way for rents to go higher. And
but
I don't
suppressing.
Talk like the stranger. You didn't say this, but someone else did. The median rent is $2,200 here now. It went up 5%. That's even more than San Francisco, which only went up something like 2%.
I'm not saying rent shouldn't be controlled or shouldn't go down. I'm just saying that suppressing the city's actively. Saying no, these platforms exist, and the city is saying keep them out of our city as one more tool to help, for better or for worse, to help.
But
keep
that's
a
not
lid
that's
on.
Not what the city's doing. The city is not imposing this as a means of rent control. They're trying to protect renters in a market that is savage
that's
right
now.
That's
what rent control is.
But they're not imposing actual rent. Yeah. Rents have to be held to some number. Is my version of rent control?
Yeah, it's a different. Rent control is illegal here.
It is trying to level a playing field that is extremely not level, right? And I think that if you were to say that the city barred landlords from accepting bribes from prospective renters, I would say, yeah, that's fair. That's not suppressing rents or punishing landlords. That's just saying, let's try to level the playing field so that it's not only the people who can, offer fancy expensive bribes to landlords, that it's not only they who get the first dibs on the apartments.
Yeah.
So this was just making it easier to do what's actually happening on the house buying side of things.
Exactly. That's how house buying works.
House buying is the same thing. It's everybody, seeing a price and then everybody overbidding because there's a limited supply and everyone wants to be the special one that gets the house.
So imagine if the city outlawed bidding on homes for purchase. That's right. What's the difference?
This is something that I will never have to consider because I'm a millennial and will never own a home.
Right.
This argument is beyond me.
But you understand what I'm saying? I'm not saying that the city should or shouldn't do it. I'm just trying to be
clear. They didn't outlaw
about.
The practice. They outlawed this mechanism of doing it. In other words, they know even if, there's rent bidding going on right now without these folks. Tons of it. Mm-hmm. It's going on endlessly. So when someone comes over and says, I'd like to rent, and hey, I'll paint the house for you or something. There's all kinds of ways to be the preferred, chosen renter.
Right.
And bidding also, I think, reinforces something that the city of Seattle has also tried to crack down on, which is source of income discrimination, right? So if you are on a Section 8 voucher and you're looking for housing, but someone, you have a competitor who's not on Section 8 and they're obviously going to bid more, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of, I think that reinforces the possibility of discrimination without making it explicit.
In fact, the city already requires that landlords rent on a first come, first serve basis. So there's a question of whether a rent bidding platform conflicts with that.
Well, that's why they want the time to study it, to figure out what is the impact of doing something like this. And I say hooray for city because we don't need anything else in here that's denying people access to housing.
Coming up on the Week in Review, we're going to talk about a rally. Here's Citizen University. There's something that you can do, right, Eric?
Absolutely.
Gather in Seattle tomorrow. This is part of a nationwide project. And there was a little bit of movement on gun regulations in Seattle with a new proposal in the city this week. So that's coming up. It's the Week in Review on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke with Eric Liu, Sidney Brownstone, Joni Balter. You can expect thousands of people tomorrow at the Seattle March for Our Lives rally from Capitol Hill to Seattle Center. It's part of a national rally to reduce gun violence. And here's an ad that organizers created.
To the gun manufacturers who count on sales to go up every time kids are killed in their classrooms, we see you.
To the politicians who trade the lives of their constituents for a paycheck from gun lobbyists,
we see you very well. To the NRA, who pretend that weapons designed to maximize human slaughter have anything to do with the Second Amendment,
we see you.
And to the people marching this Saturday,
the people saying,
"Never again!"
We'll see you there.
Seattle is part of this national rally, and there's no downside, right? This is an example. This might have been organized on Facebook in part, for all we know.
Eric, I have a funny feeling it was. I think that was one of the first things that the group did, March for Our Lives, was they announced that they were going to be active.
Absolutely.
A walk out of class day and a rally like this. I think they put it on Facebook and probably Twitter and everywhere else.
The platform we were decrying a few minutes ago on the show.
The platform that we'll probably get back to because it's useful sometimes and plenty of times. I could have sworn I heard the voice of Rhiannon Razzarettinum in there. She's going to be on Civic Cocktail on April 4th.
And I profiled her. You can
and she did, absolutely.
In The Stranger.
Yeah.
These kids are so impressive that they know that their voices, when they say, "We see you," that they know that their message is so powerful, and that they know when they're sort of hearing stuff that sounds kind of bureaucratic and we're not going to do anything, and they keep going. They call BS, as the Parkland students did. I'm very impressed by these kids. I'm thrilled that they see. I was talking to somebody on the way here, on the way driving to KUOW, where she was saying, they see this march tomorrow, not as the end of their work, but as the beginning of their work, that this is a long time movement, that they're going to register folks to vote. And I was so happy to hear that part because Eric Liu will love this, because, you know, it's great to have these rallies. They're very impressive and great to walk out of school and all of that. But the action is at the ballot box. And if you don't vote, and I'm sorry, but younger voters tend not to show up in midterms. But the idea here is that these motivated, changed students are not only going to register, but in the fall they're going to vote and try to change the gun culture in Congress, because it's, look what they've done, nothing.
Well, I think the key is that not only converting protest into power at the ballot box, but also recognizing that this is what's happening this weekend with this March for Our Lives is part of a wave, a great surge of civic engagement that's been unfolding over the last year and a half. Right. I mean, I think we can thank Donald Trump in some ways for sparking this surge. It's the biggest surge we've seen in this country since 50 years ago.
Is there a surge in voter registration that we know of?
Anecdotally, there hasn't been any statistical reports of that yet. But I think if you look at the special elections that have been held over the last few months as indicators of a wave to come. It's not just that those elections are going to Democrats, but that the numbers of people turning out, registering and turning out for specials are now matching or exceeding the numbers that you'd expect in a general election in midterms. Right. And so I think this broader wave right now is really important to recognize. But also, again, listening to the voices in that ad, these are young people, not as our students, not as people seeking guidance or wisdom, but young people as our teachers. Right. They are showing us how to cut through the BS. They're showing us how to frame issues, how to change the story and the equation and the game of power in ways that actually those of us who are older than them and those of us who've been wanting to make a difference on gun reform and gun responsibility can be taking notes and learning from. I think that's, and they've already succeeded in Florida, and they're part of a wider wave around the country now.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're also stressing that their lives and their safety are a nonpartisan issue. And I think that this activism, I'm really excited to see where it goes in kind of purple districts or suburban areas, because in our state even, you know, we have Democrats with A-plus ratings from the NRA. So can these kids make NRA donations politically unpopular? I think that's one major question. And I think the other thing that they're drawing real attention to is that no one uses a semi-automatic rifle for hunting deer. And if you do, maybe you should develop a new hobby. But
by the way, so I went out to a shooting range with Dave Workman, who we all probably are familiar with, the Second Amendment guy, and he tells me that people like to hunt with semi-automatic rifles.
Well, then they should become better hunters. But I think this gets to another underlying anxiety present in America. I think Americans, because of our history, kind of always want the option of overthrowing the government if it becomes necessary. Like, I grew up shooting guns, and that's because I grew up in a family where, you know, the idea was Hitler could come to power again. But the fact of the matter is, the Warsaw Uprising, they had guns. It didn't make a difference. And I think we're going to have to recognize the fact that if our military decides to have martial law, the citizens aren't going to be able to stand up.
We do have at our disposal,
you know what,
a very peaceful way to effect a revolution, and we'll see that this fall, and that is to cast a ballot.
The clock on the wall tells me it's time to say, by the way, the rally again starts Cal Anderson Park, Capitol Hill, Seattle, 10 o'clock tomorrow, goes to the International Fountain at Seattle Center. This show is made for you today by Aman Al-Saadi, Ajua Jimabrempong, Jason Pagano, social media producer Kara McDermott. Coming up on Monday, we'll be talking with a Merriam-Webster editor about the words you love and hate and why. We've been talking today to Eric Liu, and Eric's new book, by the way, is You're More Powerful Than You Think. Joni Baltra is here from Civic Cocktail. Sydney Brownstone from The Stranger. Thank you all.
And thank you.
Thanks for listening. Thanks for tweeting, Maggie, you and everyone else. Join us again next week.